Well, today we are going to complete Genesis chapter 3. Now, that does not mean we'll cover every single item here. It could take many more weeks to really do justice to the closing part of Genesis 3, but we're going to do what we can. And what doesn't get done, doesn't get done, okay? Now, I invite your comments and questions. I have some things up here. I can fill the time. But there are things I'm going to have to skip because I just don't have time. But if there's some burning question you have or something in one of the verses we read and you want to discuss that, then please put your hand up. We'll get a microphone over to you, and you can help shape and guide this lesson as we go through. So let's begin. We're going to start in verse 6. It says, "And the woman perceived that the tree was good for eating, and that it was a craving, a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable as a means of intelligence. And she took of its fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized that they were naked. And they sewed together a fig leaf and made themselves aprons. They heard the sound or voice of Adonai Elohim manifesting itself in the garden toward evening. And the man and his wife hid from Adonai Elohim among the trees of the garden. Adonai Elohim called out to the man and said to him, 'Echa, where are you?' He said, 'I heard the voice of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I am naked, so I hid.' And he said, 'Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree from which I commanded you not to eat?' The man said, 'The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I ate.' And Adonai Elohim said to the woman, 'What is this that you have done?' The woman said, 'The serpent deceived me, and I ate.' And Adonai Elohim said to the serpent, 'Because you have done this, accursed are you beyond all the cattle and beyond all the beasts of the field. Upon your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He will pound or crush your head, and you will pound or crush his heel.' To the woman he said, 'I will greatly increase your pain and your childbearing. In pain shall you bear children. Yet your craving shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you or rule in you.' To Adam he said, 'Because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate of the tree about which I commanded you, saying, "You shall not eat of it," accursed is the ground because of you. Through pain shall you eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles shall it sprout for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. By the sweat of your brow shall you eat bread until you return to the ground from which you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust shall you return.'" The man called his wife's name Chava, our English translation say Eve, because she had become the mother of all the living. And Adonai Elohim made for Adam and his wife garments of skin, and he clothed them. And Adonai Elohim said, "Behold, man has become like one among us, knowing good and bad. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also the tree of life and eat and live forever." So Adonai Elohim banished him from the Garden of Eden to work the soil from which he was taken. Because recall, Adam was created outside the garden and brought into it. And now he's going back to the soil outside the garden from which he was taken. And having driven out the man, he stationed at the east of the Garden of Eden the cherubim and the flame of the ever-turning sword, or double-edged sword, to guard the way to the tree of life. There is so much going on here in this chapter that it's frustrating to even think about trying to cover it. We'll do what we can. So, let's start with this. And again, I invite your comments and questions as we go through. God's question to Adam is, "Where are you?" And in Hebrew, that's one word, echa, echa. But it just so happens that echa is the name of the book of Lamentations, which we read earlier in the prayer service. Lamentations is read in the synagogue on Tishba Av, and at sundown tonight, Tishba Av begins. Tishba Av is a horrible day on the Jewish calendar. It was the day, traditionally, it's believed that the spies brought back the evil report about the land, and then Israel had to wander for 40 years in the wilderness. It's the day where the first temple was destroyed. It's the same day in 70 AD that the second temple was destroyed. It's the day that England drove out all its Jews. It's the day in 1492 when Spain and Portugal drove out all their Jews. It's the day in 1914 that World War I began, that led to all the pogroms and to finally the Holocaust later that destroyed so many Jewish lives. And there are many other events. Tishba Av is a day of fasting and mourning in Israel. But praise God, in Zechariah tells us that when Messiah comes, establishes his kingdom, it becomes a day of feasting and celebration. And so may God haste the day that that happens. So Echa is the very first word of Lamentations, is therefore the name of the book of Lamentations. And all the lamentations that take place, all the lamenting, traces its source back to Genesis 3, when Adam and Eve sinned. Now, the word Echa means where. It's not the normal word for where. Epho is the normal word for where. Like, where are my keys? You know, where did I park the car? That sort of thing. But Echa, it has an underlying sense of distress and pain. When something precious is supposed to be right here, and it's not here anymore. Like, I left my child in the car seat here while I was looking some clothes here at the mall. I turn around and he's gone. Echa, that's the kind of echa. That's the kind of sense that this word has. It also is an exclamation of, how could this happen? How could it happen? And that's why the first word of Lamentations is in English, how. But in both places, the Hebrew word is Echa. Where are you? Now, you have to remember, God never, ever, ever, ever asks a question that he doesn't already know the answer to. He knows everything. When God asks a question, it's for the purpose of opening up a path in our minds for truth to come in. It is always to open a path for truth. But Satan began his conversation with Eve also with a question. His question was two words, off-key. Indeed, perhaps, are you sure, God said, you can't eat from this tree? He asked a question, but was it to open up a path for truth or to cause doubt? You know, some people have said, there's no such thing as a stupid question. I kind of think there is, after 30 years of teaching public school. I think I've heard a few. But there are definitely such things as wicked questions. And I've heard more than one person who tries to cause doubt in someone else's mind. They say, I'm just asking questions. Well, so is Satan. So always identify the source of a question. Is the question asked to stir up doubt? Or is the question asked to open a path so truth can enter? When God asks a question, it's always for the sake of allowing truth to come in. So when he asks Adam, where are you? What he's hoping Adam will do is begin to answer that question for himself. Yeah, how did I get here? How did I get here? Everything was so great, and then I ate that thing that God commanded me strictly, don't eat from that tree. And the first question God asks in the entire Bible is this question. So that is the question he asks everybody. And I think when we begin to share God's word with people who don't know him, one of the first questions we should ask is, well, where are you? Where are you in your life? How are things going? Are you tired of doing things your own way yet? So he says, where are you? He said, I heard the voice of you in the garden. Now, this is kind of important to me. It says back in verse 7, their eyes were opened. But somehow their eyes were opened, but they didn't see as well as they did. It's kind of a conundrum, you know? Because I believe they used to see God. Used to walk with him, talk with him, commune with him. But now it's just the voice we hear. Satan had promised, when you eat of this tree, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. But his promise had a bit of truth in it, but there was a real catch to it. It's like someone telling a blind man, I can heal you and make your eyes work so you can see. But you'll have to spend the rest of your life in the dark. It reminds me of a stupid movie I saw years ago. And in this movie, these people had superpowers. This one young man had a superpower. He could turn invisible, but only if you weren't watching. You know, it's like, so what good is it? What good is to have your eyes opened if you're losing something more important? I believe up to this point, Adam and Eve could see, but they saw everything through the filter of God's love. They saw everything through God's light, through the presence of their relationship with God. They saw everything by its spiritual essence. And now that their eyes had opened, their eyes now failed to be enlightened. When we were reading the prayers this morning, going through the prayers, there's part in one of the lines in the prayer book where it says, enlighten our eyes with your Torah. And I think with Adam and Eve, on one way their eyes were opened, but the lights went out. And they saw, were naked. Now God asked two more questions. Verse 11, he said, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree from which I commanded you not to eat? Now notice he doesn't call it the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's the tree I told you not to eat from. Now, what's the answer to the first question? Adam doesn't answer that. Who told you that you're naked? It seems like a dumb question because, well, I can kind of see it for myself. Nobody had to tell me. But it's an important question. And the answer is actually there. If we go back a few verses, you'll find the verse back in verse 7. It says, then the eyes of both of them were opened and they realized that they were naked. So who told them that they were naked? Their eyes did. Their eyes did. You see, when they were in communion with God and had they eaten of the tree of life, I think their eyes would have been opened that way too, but in a more glorious way, a fuller way. But what had happened when they began to live according to knowledge of good and evil, rather than strictly just relationship and obedience to God, then all of a sudden they saw their nakedness in a different way. They saw it apart from the light of God's presence, from the innocence of relationship with God, and they were ashamed and they were embarrassed. Now, I wasn't going to get into this and but you know, we've got time. I'm going to go ahead and do this. I just kind of threw this in. I've been thinking about this. I've been in conversation about this with some friends. And I call this the mirror effect. And you can make of it what you will. But you know, those who do not see God clearly do not see themselves clearly. Now we tend to think that now that Adam and Eve had eaten of this fruit, they saw themselves clearly. We're naked. We already knew they're naked. We're told that at the end of chapter 2. But the thing is, they were not seeing God clearly anymore. And you know what? The nakedness they beheld themselves was not because they saw themselves more clearly. They saw themselves more starkly without being clothed with the Shekinah of God. Tradition says that Adam and Eve were clothed in the light of God, the or of God. The Hebrew word for or is spelled with an aleph, or. And they say that they were just clothed in his light. But when they sinned, the lights went out. And the Hebrew word for skin is also or, spelled with an ayin. Sounds exactly the same, just change the first silent letter from an aleph to an ayin. And now all they saw was the skin. So in one way, they saw themselves more clearly, but not as completely. Rob and I were talking about this. This may be a really dumb example, and maybe it's distracting, shouldn't share it, but here it goes anyway. Do you think you have the best chance of really getting to know someone's soul if they're sitting across from you fully clothed? or if they're sitting across from you completely naked. If they're clothed, you can really talk about their soul and about the issues in their life. If they're naked, I don't even know how I'd carry on a conversation with someone who's naked. I don't even know how I would do it. But I don't think it'd be a very fruitful conversation. I'd be like, okay, tell me about yourself. You know. So the clothing, though it can conceal, it can also very much reveal. And I think that the light that Adam and Eve were clothed in, it concealed to a degree, but also revealed the glory of God that was in them. And so when the lights went out, yeah, their eyes were open, but their eyes were not enlightened any longer. So those who do not see God clearly don't see themselves very clearly. I've always noticed this. People don't know God, don't have a healthy God concept, don't have a relationship with Him, really don't know themselves very well. They have all kinds of distorted ideas about themselves. They see them as being the very best or the very worst or this and that. And it's like, you don't really see what's going on. But those who do see God clearly, they have a healthy God's concept and a good connection with God. They see themselves clearly. Now, this has a negative and a positive to it. That means they see all their own flaws and all their shortcomings now. But they also can see themselves through God's eyes of love, and there's hope. There's always hope. You know, when the enemy speaks, you can always tell his voice from God's. When the enemy speaks, there's no hope. You know, but when God speaks and rebukes, there's always an underlying sense of hope. I can fix this. If I repent and turn to Him and begin to do what's right, things can turn around. There's always an underlying sense. You can fix this. This can be changed. Follow me. With the enemy, it's always hopelessness. Total emptiness and hopelessness. All right? Now, Carla, I saw your hand up. So let's get a mic over to Carla here. If you're visiting, remember, you're welcome to share comments, ask questions. Okay, Carla.
It seems like what was changed was the context. Yeah. In other words, everything becomes subjective.
Yeah,
it does. It's all about me now. Yeah. So we never see things clearly.
That's right. Yeah. So for what little thing might have been gained, something much bigger is lost. Much bigger is lost, yeah. Very well put. Thank you. Now, this thing about seeing yourself is reflected in the mirror. You know, when you look in a mirror, you see two images. When you look in a mirror, you see two images. One image is the image that's right there being reflected back. That's physical. That's what science can describe. But there's another image you see. And you cannot look in the mirror at yourself without this second image. That's the image in your mind. Because why do you look in the mirror in the morning? You want to see the reality and to compare it with your mind of what the reality should be. Oh, I need to comb my hair. I need to brush my teeth. I need to wipe some cornflakes off my face. I need to change my clothes. I need to trim something or do something. So there's an image in your mind of what it should be. Now, an animal looks in the mirror. It just sees an image looking back. It means nothing to him because there's not that second image in the animal's mind. But when we look in the mirror, there's an image we have in our mind, and then there's an image we see. Now, ego will totally distort that image. Ego can do one of two things. A beautiful woman can look at a mirror, but she doesn't say beautiful woman. She sees an awful, ugly, hideous hag. And then she begins to practice bulimia or goes to anorexia, refuses to eat because she sees someone who's overweight when she may be very thin because her ego has distorted her image of what she sees. Or somebody will look in the mirror and they might be a hag. They'll think, oh, but a person who does this doesn't have a very healthy inner image at all. A person who's humble, for a person where the ego is set aside, they can look and they can see what's there, and they can deal with it. They do what needs to be done. And the Bible works the same way. The Bible is called a mirror. For example, when we look into the mirror of the Word, we see two images. One image is the one described in James 1, 23 and 24. It says, if anyone is a hearer of the Word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. Okay, what's the mirror? The Word. He's reading the Word. He's looking at the Word to get information. So he's looking in the mirror. But he's not a doer of the Word. So he's like someone who looks at his natural face in a mirror. For once he has looked at himself and gone away, he immediately forgets what kind of person he was. So in other words, the Bible, when you look into it, will reveal what kind of person you are. For example, I might have a deep flaw in my life and in my behavior, and I may not know it until, like, I'm not supposed to be doing this thing I've been doing. I know for most young people, they go around guys, you know. Girls tend to have a negative self-image and look in the mirror, just a typical thing about men and women. Guys will walk past the mirror and say, yeah, you know, good. And they'll start looking proud. And then you read in Proverbs that of the things God hates, one of the things he hates the most is a proud look. Really? I didn't know that. So now you realize, okay, I've been doing something the Bible is reflecting back to me, saying, this is not good, don't do this. And I can either say, well, forget that, I'm going to look the way I want. Or you can begin to change that image to where what you begin to see in the mirror, what you are and what the Bible says begin to agree with one another. You understand? So the Bible is a mirror of you. But there's a second image the Bible reflects. It's the image of God. You look into the Bible, you also see God's image. And this is where things really come to play. The Bible has this magic way of showing you who you are and showing you who God is. And you're made in his image. You're supposed to be after his likeness. You begin to realize these two images do not agree. And I'm not going to change God into my image. So either I can close the book and just forget, like James says here, or I can look in the book and begin to change me so that I begin to agree and look more like what the Bible says a man should be, as a woman should be. And then the two images begin to merge. But all the time, there are two images. And as we look into the Word, we need to see both of those images. And if you have humility, you can do that. If you have ego, you can't. You'll look at the Word and think it's describing you and thinking, you're wonderful. This is what the Pharisees, the hypocritical Pharisees did. So, Yeshua, in the chapter we read from John 5 earlier, says, you search the scriptures, for in them you think you will find life. He says, but you won't come to me so you can have life. And the scriptures speak about me. So they were studying the scriptures, they couldn't see themselves. They just couldn't see themselves because ego distorted what they read. And they thought, yeah, I'm doing good. I'm just like what the Bible describes. I am just like what the Torah says a person should be. So let's be very careful. Let's exercise humility so we can see clearly who we are and clearly who God is and then begin to make the changes we need to make. All right? So that's my little rabbi trail. Let's get back onto the text now. Oh, yes, question over here. Adam, let's get a microphone to Adam. It's quite all right.
So a lot of the time you're talking, I was just, well, I guess looking back at times in my past when I've looked at myself in the mirror.
Yeah.
And I used to have this suit coat. It was the first article clothing my dad had purchased for himself when he was a teenager. And it happened to fit me through college, and I still have it now. When I look at it now, I recognize that it looks ridiculous because it's actually like a fuchsia pink plaid suit. It's slick. But
okay, how many want to see Adam in that coat next week?
All right.
Once
it pulls off, but I remember as a high schooler putting that on before something I needed to dress up as, and just being like, "Dang, I look good in this," you know. And it's just amazing how sometimes we can look in the mirror and we really fail to see what's in the mirror. It just drives home the importance of having other people in our lives,
yes,
who accept the responsibility, and I don't say opportunity, but responsibility,
yeah,
of bringing truth in other people's lives. And one of the best examples I have is he's actually my current stepfather, but when he was just my dad's bowling buddy, my brother was real determined on the bowling. He was like five. And Paul said, wow, you make a really good wrestler. And just that little tidbit, recognizing the strength, encouraging it, and directing it, then set really the pace for my brother's entire life now. And I think how much of a responsibility is for us, especially us older men, to recognize it in younger men, positive traits, and say, hey, you may see this in Veer, but this is what I see.
Yeah, well put. That's great. But please don't call yourself an old man. What's that supposed to mean to me feel like, huh? No, thank you, Adam. That's very insightful. Appreciate that. Thank you. Well, then the blame game begins. The man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree that I ate. And then he asked the woman, oh, well, the devil made me do it. You know, so everybody's passing the blame. So there's that surface lesson we've all heard, we all get. But there's something deeper going on here. Because if your Bible says, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate, it's improper translation. This is what it says. She gave me of the tree and I will eat. It's future tense. There's something very deep going on here. Now, this is one of the things about the scriptures I just love. You can read it on the surface level, but then always there's something deeper going on underneath. On the surface level, you see our first parents, Adam and Eve, really messing up and making life painful for all their children, which includes us, all these thousands of years later. But on the other hand, there's something deeper going on. Paul knew this, and the rabbis often write about this. They say that Adam also is a picture of the Messiah. And this is why Paul over in Corinthians refers to Adam, and then refers to Yeshua as the last Adam. And you think, why would you refer to Yeshua as an Adam? Isn't Adam the cause of all of our mess? Why would you want to name Messiah after Adam? Well, don't forget that Adam also is the father of all the life in this world, too. But if you do a little review, and you read the story of Adam, and think of Messiah, here's what you'll see. Adam could not find a helpmate for him. So God put him in a deep sleep. Tardema is the word. Put him in a deep sleep. And what is death called in the Bible? Sleep, right? So it's almost like Adam died. It's a picture of death. And during, out of his death, he takes his side and forms a bride. Then Adam comes back awake. And then this bride is complete, and the Father, God, presents the bride to the man. See the picture of the gospel there? Who is the bride that's being formed right now? It's us, right? But there's something more going on. You can look at this one way that Adam is blaming the woman, but another way he's explaining, he says, listen, the woman you gave to me, who I love with all my heart and all my soul. This woman who I can't imagine living without. She gives me food. I'm going to eat it. Whatever she chooses to go, wherever she chooses to go, I'm going with her. I am not going to be separated from her. She gives me something to eat. I'm going to eat it too. I hear an echo of Messiah there saying, if my bride is going to go into a dark and painful place, I'm going to go with her, to be with her. And he did. You see that? And Paul tells us later on, he says, it's over in Timothy, in 1 Timothy 2:14, says, it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being quite deceived fell into the transgression. It's almost like Adam, there was no deception here with him. He went into this with his eyes wide open. There was no deception. He didn't have conversation with a serpent. He had conversation with his wife. She'd eaten of the fruit. So it's like, then I'm going to eat it too, because I'm going to be with you. She was trying to get something. She was deceived trying to get something. But he, on his hand, it looked like he was motivated by love for her. There's no temptation involved. And any kind of popular culture tries to say, well, Eve tempted Adam to eat the fruit. That's not mentioned in the text. He realized what she had done. And so he partakes of the fruit for a completely different motive. Her motive is because she wanted something she didn't think she had. His motive was so he wouldn't lose the one he loved. See the difference? And that's how Messiah is. Now, Messiah did not sin for us, but it says he became sin for us. And he took our sin upon himself. And he suffered the consequences of our sin. So if Adam did indeed partake of the fruit out of his love and purpose to unite with his wife, then that certainly is a picture of our Messiah. Yeah. And Jim, I see your hand up. Let's get a mic over to Jim here. There we go.
What's the true meaning of, in the passage where it says, as soon as you eat, you shall be like God? Are we not to be desirous to be like God?
Ah, great question.
Like God when
yes.
The mind of Christ?
Now, we talked about that in our first teaching on chapter 3 a little bit. But just a quick review of that. Yeah, and to that one, it's like it's like a bad commercial where, I don't know, what's some big pop hero today?
Justin Bieber.
Oh, No. Iron Man, okay? So you see a toy commercial. Well, you get this mask, and you buy this new toy, you put this on, and when you push a button, it sounds like Iron Man talking, and you'll be like Iron Man. Well, you put the mask on, yeah, it looks like Iron Man, but now you're only this tall, these little tiny arms, and you can't, you know. It's like, you're not fooling anybody. So when he says, you'll be like God knowing good and evil, all right. But now they were disconnected from God, disconnected from life, disconnected from the life source. Now they were in sin, and God's not a sinner. They were now unrighteous. He's not unrighteous. God is light. Now they're in darkness. So, yeah, this one little way, like the little mask, little toy mask. Yeah, okay, they like God, but look what they lost. And remember, a half-truth is a whole lie, and the enemy only told them a half-truth. In fact, maybe just a little tiny bit, not even half of a truth when he said that. Yeah. And was there another hand up back? Yes, back in the back. I think it's on, just to put up real close.
You said that this is future tense. Could you drill down a little bit on that? Because I don't understand. I mean, it's read as I will. Yeah. It's read as past tense.
I know. Every translation does that.
Is Hebrew saying it's future tense?
Yeah, the future tense. Yeah, the word in Hebrew is va'ochel. And it should be ochel. Ochel is past tense. Va'ochel makes it future tense. Hebrew only has a past and a future. They call it a perfect and an imperfect. We call it past and future. And this is very clear as day, future tense. And the rabbis all comment on this, by the way. So it was, because I saw that, but I didn't trust myself. But yeah, the rabbis all agree. It is a future tense. It just sounds so weird that English translators always make it past tense. And they do that with a lot of things, because otherwise they would sound odd. But God says, leave it alone. I meant it to sound a little odd, so you look into it and see what it's really saying. But, yeah, it really is future tense. Okay, thank you for the question. Let's go a bit further. He starts by talking to the serpent then. He asks the woman, and she says, a serpent deceived me. Then verse 14, and God said to the Nachash, to the serpent, because you have done this, accursed are you beyond all the cattle and beyond all beasts of the field. And we spoke back again, back in the first part of chapter 3, that the serpent at one time didn't go around on his belly. In fact, he's probably more like a dragon, which is what he is called over in Revelation. So you can picture a dragon with legs, arms, or at least four legs, wings. But he curses him, says from now on the serpent goes on his belly. But that's not the way it was. At one time, this serpent had to have been a very grand, spectacular, beautiful creature. But now it's something that kind of makes you like, oh, get out of the way, there's a snake in the room. And this helps us understand what the word arur, curse, means. Curse is not some kind of a witchcraft thing. Curse means abilities are removed. That's what it means. You can be a believer, yet because of things you're doing in your life, you can have God's curse on you. It doesn't mean you don't make any progress, but your progress is more difficult and it's more labored, and it's more fraught with difficulties. It's just hard to keep moving ahead. Blessing, on the other hand, is the opposite. It means we do things and they just go. They're just like oil in the gears and it's smooth. It doesn't mean there's no pain, but curse and blessing are the opposites. Curse means things are made more difficult and requires a lot of extra effort to accomplish small things. Blessing means you get the greatest reward for the amount of effort put in. Yes, microphone to Tim.
Maybe you're going to touch on this, but then how are cattle cursed? If you say they're cursed more than all the cattle, in that description.
Oh, what he's, thanks, great question. What he's saying is, you were way up here. Of all the creatures, you were just El Primo. You were the best. You're the most beautiful, the most talented, the brightest. But now, you're right down the bottom of the heap. Right at the bottom of the heap. In fact, there's no other animal, unless you get into insects, but I'm talking about beasts of the field, that just go on their belly like this. Only snakes do, just on their belly. Think about that. You wonder how they move at all without any kind of arms or legs. It's pretty amazing. So what it simply means, you go from the top down to the bottom. Yeah. But there's more going on here. He says, upon your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. Where did Adam come from? Dust. Where will he go to? Dust. Dust is a picture of death. And he's telling the serpent, basically, are you going to feed on dead things? The only kind of food the enemy can ever offer you is dead stuff. And don't forget that though he may have lost his wings and arms and legs, he still has a mouth that works really well. And that's the only weapon the enemy has. Satan is called a serpent, a snake. And the working end of a snake is its mouth. And his only weapon is his mouth. And his only poison, his only weapon is the poison of the lie. That's the only thing he's got going for him. He has no arms or legs. He can't do anything. But what he can do is deceive. And the moment you begin to believe his lies, then you do his work for him. The only arms and legs he has are the ones you yield to him to use. You understand? And this whole nonsense about this how great and powerful Satan is, it's just nonsense. He isn't great and powerful. You have much more power than he does. Just don't yield it to him. Don't believe his lies. Okay? All you have to do is resist him. Then who does the running? He runs away from you. He has so much to fear from you. If you put your armor on and you have the sword of the Spirit and you have the truth, you know the real deal about who you are, who God is, and who that thing is, he'll go running away. All right? He has no authority. He has no power over you. None. John tells us he can't even touch you. So, now I know people are going to ask questions about demon possession, but we're not going to get into that today, this morning. That's for another time. And then he's, one other thing. You know, at the end of the chapter, we see Adam and Eve removed from the garden. What happened to Satan? Is he kicked out of the garden? Doesn't say he is. I believe every time we begin to make our way back towards the tree of life, we'll encounter him. He'll be right there to tell us half-truths, to deceive us, and to discourage us and trip us up. Whenever we're on our way to the tree of life, we're going to find him. He's still there. He really is. But the thing is, we've got Genesis 3. We're on to him. We shouldn't be deceived by him. All right, now I'm going to go on without stopping. So upon your belly you should go, and dust shall eat all the days of your life. Verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. So there's enmity here on two levels. And nobody talks about the first one. I'll put enmity between you and the woman. You could also read it as, I'll put enmity between you and womankind. And women, I want to tell you something. You, even more than men, have a target on your back by the enemy. Because he knows If he can get women to lower the standards, all society will follow. Standards in a society are not set by men. It's not in us to do that. They're set by women. Standards in the home must be set by the woman. And women is like that Yiddish saying, a woman can turn a man into a schmuck or into a king. And women, that's the power you have. And one of the greatest enemies of women, one group that has bought the serpent's lie and has powerfully destroyed women in this day and age, is the feminist movement. Because there's nothing feminine about it. It's an insult to women because it's trying to make you women into men. Why would you want to be a man? And men don't want a woman or to marry another man in a woman's body. Women have, in these days, have forgotten their power. I'm telling you something. A woman who is pure and who is modest and is self-controlled will inspire a man to do things he never thought he could do. And she will be respected by men she doesn't even know. They will respect her in a way that others will stand back and say, how does she do that? Because I'll tell you what is wired into men. When you see a godly woman, a modest woman, a wise, self-possessed woman, men all of a sudden feel like they're in the presence of their mom. They feel like, what can I do for you? They become gentlemen. But boy, when women lower the standards, men become animals. And the feminist movement has made so many women forget that. And has tried to give women the goals of that men have. Be the top in the field, top in the business, make all the money. And then they're laying aside something that's much more powerful. Something much more important. Something men can never, ever achieve or do. And should not try. And that's to be a godly woman. Remember, God created Adam and then he created the upgrade. Okay? And I'm not kidding. And the feminist movement is the enemy of women. You want to talk about the war on women? Look at the feminist movement. It's doing its best to destroy femininity and womanhood. And all society's paying the cost. So, there's this war between the enemy and women. And it's right here. I'll put enmity between you and the woman. And that war has been going on and it's really waging today. And then he says, I'll put enmity between your seed, speaking to the serpent, between your seed and her seed. He will pound your head. So her seed is referring to one person. But the enemy's seed refers to a bunch of people. Who are the enemy's seed? Who is the enemy's seed? Anyone who adopts his program. There's a great passage in John 8 that describes this. Yeshua is talking to some of the hypocritical leaders, the ones who are eventually going to execute him. And he's talking to them in John 8. Verse 44, listen to what Yeshua says to these people. He says, you are of your father, the devil. This is a reference right back to this verse in Genesis 3. The enemy's seed. He's saying, you are Satan's seed. Now, he's not talking about Jews. He's talking about religiously hypocritical people in leadership. Don't think he's talking about Jews. All right? All of his disciples were Jews, right? But he's talking about those who follow the enemy. And they come to a place of leadership. And they're pushing the enemy's program. Because remember, the enemy's seed has enmity against the woman's seed, the Messiah. But look what he says. You are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. What did these leaders want to do to Yeshua? They wanted to crush his head. See, when you crush somebody's head, they're dead. You get it? They wanted to destroy him, but they didn't. So it says, he, the woman's seed, will crush your head, Satan, but you will crush his heel. All right, think about it. You've got a heel, you've got a head. Which would you rather have crushed? Your head's crushed, you're gone. Your heel's crushed, all right. You might limp for a little while, it'll heal up. You'll be all right. And so if you're crushing a serpent's head, what part of your body are you going to use? Your elbow? Your forehead? What are you going to do? You're going to use your heel. You're going to come down on him with your heel. So at the time the heel comes down against the head is crushed, the heel is crushed. They're both damaged. And this is what happened at the crucifixion. Satan was destroyed at the crucifixion. And he knows it. Now, we don't see the fruit of that destruction quite yet. But by the time you get to Revelation 12, then you see it. He's letting him play out. You ever wonder why when you kill a snake, it's still shaking and moving and doing everything? In fact, after you kill a snake, cut it in two, it can still bite you. So Satan, for all practical purposes, is done with. But he's still writhing and moving and still in his death throes, doing all the damage he can do. In the meantime, Yeshua's heel was crushed. What's the heel? It's the lowest part of the body. In other words, his body was crucified. But he rose from the dead. It's all healed. But there's a play on words going on. Let me show you some of these. First of all, the word for serpent in Hebrew is the word nachash. There you see it on the left. Nachash. And every Hebrew word has a numerical value. Nachash is 358. The word Messiah, which is Mashiach in Hebrew, there it is, also has a numerical value of exactly 358. That's no coincidence. What God is teaching us here is that all the damage done by the serpent is perfectly eradicated by the work of Messiah. You see? Exactly. Right to the last... The last decimal point, you know. The Nakash is completely erased by Mashiach. But here's something else that's interesting. The word for heel in Hebrew is the word akev. There it is. Now, when Jacob was born, he was a twin. And what was he doing when he came out of his mother's womb? He's grasping his brother Esau's heel. So what did they name him? Yaakov. You see the word heel there? Same word. Just add the yud in the front, and now you have the name Jacob, Yaakov. And Yaakov has some different meanings like grasper, usurper. He's a grabber. And what did he grab? He grabbed his brother's heel. Was Yeshua a son of Jacob? A descendant of Jacob? Yeah. And all through Jacob's history, all Jews are descendants of Jacob. There's Abraham, who had Isaac, who had Jacob, and Jacob had the 12 tribes. All Jews descend from Jacob. And all through their life, Satan has been crushing their heel. He's been after the seed of the woman to destroy the Messiah. And Jacob has been crushed. But it's through Jacob, it's through this one whose name means heel, that the serpent has finally dealt the death blow. Isn't that amazing? It's really great. So then... God curses the serpent. Did God curse the woman? Did he curse the man? No. Don't ever think for a moment God cursed Adam and Eve. He cursed the serpent and he curses the ground. He does not curse Adam. He does not curse Eve. There are consequences they have to pay. He doesn't curse them though. So he says, he will crush your head, you will crush his heel. To the woman, he said, verse 16, I will greatly increase your pain and your childbearing. In pain, you shall bear children. It seems repetitive, but the way pain is used twice here, it seems to be referring to two different things. Most of the rabbis say it's referring to the physical pain, the birth pains a woman feels giving birth. I was there when Robin gave birth. Didn't seem that big a deal. I didn't feel anything. But that's horrible. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. I mean, if there's any place I think a woman comes close to experiencing death, it's probably right there in giving birth. But the other pain, they say, is in the rearing of the children. That also involves pain. And I've shared before up here that when a woman has a child, there are two umbilical cords that need to be cut. And there are two sets of birth pains she goes through. There's a physical birth pain at the time the baby is born and the umbilical cord is cut. But then years later, there'll be a second set of birth pains when that child becomes an adult. And you have to cut that invisible umbilical cord and release them into the world to live on their own. Sometimes that's more painful. One's strictly a physical pain, the other one's very much a pain of the heart. So, there are two kinds of pains that she gets. And says, your craving shall be to your husband, he shall mashal you. The word rule there is a very particular word for rule. It's a word mashal. It's the same word that's used when it says the sun will mashal the day and the moon mashal the night. Now we'll get to that another time if we want to. And then to the man, to Adam, he says, verse 17, because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate of the tree about which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat of it, accursed is the ground because of you. Through pain, same word, pain, shall you eat of it all the days of your life. Now, pain is used twice with Eve and only once with Adam. Why is that? Why does she get a double portion of pain and he just gets a single portion? She committed two sins. He committed one. She ate from the tree. He ate from the tree. Well, what's the additional thing she did? She gave to him to eat. See, if you do something wrong, all right, you did something wrong. But then when you bring someone else into your wrongdoing, that's a double sin. You follow? Right. Hand up here. Abby, let's get a microphone to Abby real quick.
Great. I kind of have two questions. I may have missed it, but did Adam know that it was the forbidden fruit and that he shouldn't have?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So then, when Adam did eat from it, wasn't he choosing Eve over God? So why was it, isn't that one of the unforgivable sins when you choose somebody else over God? So yeah. Why didn't he get?
I sure hope it's not unforgivable because we've all done that.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
Well, so, maybe I'm thinking about, no, I'm thinking about something else. So why didn't he get punished or whatever twice if he did choose his wife over
Well, his motive for eating is, yes, he chose something over God. What was her motive for eating? Choosing something over God. So both of them had committed that same sin. Slightly different reasons, but it was still choosing something over the God. Disobeying God, saying, I know better than him, and I'm wanting this instead of what he wants. But when she led him to eat, that was the second thing on top. Yeah. So, yes, microphone over to Tony here. And let's get Bill a skateboard so he can. There we go.
I think one of the things that we're missing here is the first Adam was created from the dust of the fallen world.
Yeah.
And the second Adam came from heaven.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Very true. Yes, Peter.
Thank you. My question is on curse and blessing, as mm-hmm. you give a brief definition.
Yeah.
Curse is something that's more difficult to achieve, and blessing is something that will be a lot more smoother to achieve.
Yes.
Now, with Eve and Adam having difficulty in how they will accomplish things in their lives, who can we not regard that as being cursed?
Okay, repeat that last bit. I missed just the last part there, Peter. Repeat the question at the end.
The question is, with Adam and Eve
mm-hmm.
having difficulty, because pain is something that is painful,
yes.
could be something that is difficult to get,
yeah.
can we not regard that as being a curse?
Can we regard that as being a curse?
Yes.
No, because it's not called a curse. It's just called pain. Let's, maybe this will help. What areas of pain did God send pain? What areas of endeavor? Was it, did he say, okay, you're both going to have toothaches. Adam, you'll have a toothache, and Eve, you'll have two toothaches at a time. No. What, headaches? What, no. Was it, did he take away their arms or their legs like he did with Satan? No. What areas of endeavor did they experience pain? Bringing forth life. With the woman, bringing forth offspring. With Adam, with bringing forth food, living things out of the earth that sustain life. It had to do with bringing forth life for both of them. Those are the things that would find pain. And I think the deep underlying part of this is that since they chose not to eat from the tree of life, but from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, now they really wanted the tree of life. And God says, okay, eventually the tree of life is going to be made available to mankind again. But every attempt and every step to make go back to life, you can do it, but it's going to be painful. Before it wasn't. Now it's going to be painful as you make your way back to life. And so this is why when you fall into temptation, it's so easy and so pleasant, oh, so wonderful, but afterwards comes the pain. When you begin to correct all the issues and try to make your life right again, then you begin to experience pain. People fall into addictions. The alcohol is so wonderful, and the drugs, I feel so great. But then when you try to make your way back to health, you begin to experience withdrawal and horrible pain. Anytime we make steps back to life, there's pain. This is why Yeshua says, if any man will come after me, let him take up his easy boy chair. No, his cross. Follow me. Right? So let's talk about pain for a second. The word for pain is the word etzev. Etzev, that's the word that's used three times here in Genesis. Etzev. It means pain. But you can take this exact same word and pronounce it atzav. You don't change the spelling, but when you pronounce it atzav, it means to form or to fashion. It's the word used in Job 10:8 when it says, when Job says, speaking to God, your hands atzav, your hands fashioned and made me altogether. There's a principle here, and you have to catch this. I've said it many times before, but make sure you hold on to this. All pain is birth pain. Whatever pain you feel in your life, it's some form of birth pain. And if you'll go through it, and you may have to push at the end, there's going to be new life there for you or for someone. Maybe like the woman, it's life that's going to come out of you, or like a man, it's life you're going to bring out of the ground, out of something else. But all pain is birth pain. And if you're going through pain, this is how you can have joy. You realize on the other side of this is going to be new life in some way. And you know, we should all understand this. I don't care what worthwhile endeavor you put your hand to in your life, there's going to be a wilderness period, a pain period you go through. You want to learn how to play an instrument? Great. It's all great. It's enthusiastic and fun at the beginning. And then you get to the long doldrums, like, oh, no, I have to practice. Do I have to do the exercises? And, oh, I'm so sick of this. I want to quit. Everybody goes through it. You want to become a dancer, an actor, a painter, a builder? Well, I don't care what it is. You go through this doldrum period. It's like, oh, this is hard. You push through it. You go through the pain. Then at the end, there's fruit. There's new life. And there's a career. There's a ability to bring joy into people's lives. There's something good at the other side. This is what the wilderness is. It's ordained by God. Remember when God brought Israel out of Egypt, he could just have them go straight north into Canaan. He took them all the way around to the east, into the wilderness, and then into Canaan. Why the detour? You have to go through the wilderness. It's ordained. You have to. So don't fight it. Just be courageous. And pain is just pain anyway. It's not going to kill you. Just go through it. Do it. Knowing that there's life at the end. Okay? Yes, Mim. Let's get a microphone to Mim. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Priscilla. All right, Priscilla, and then we'll go to men. Go right ahead.
Okay, is it on?
Yes.
Earlier in the lesson, I believe I heard you say, Adam knew what Eve had done, and then he took the fruit as well. Did she know what she had done?
After she did it.
Well, if she didn't know before, why would she punish twice? God said to her, don't eat. Or had Emily said to Adam, don't eat.
I don't know. Next question. Men? I deserve that. I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. That's great. I love good questions. Yeah. I'm not quite sure. That's something for all of us to think about. For that. I don't know. I didn't think. That's one that didn't occur to me. No, thank you for that. Okay, Mim. Oh, mercy. Boy, that's a high note. You, I didn't know you could hit those. Okay, no, that's okay. Just... There we go. I think it was turned up too high.
Pain.
Pain. As we just experienced, yeah.
I don't like pain. And I remember recently using pain as a line to pray.
Yes.
And you know how sometimes when we experience pain and when we pray and you said the outcome of it, there's something, the new birth, or something after that. And I remember before, I would have pain, I would complain.
Yeah.
And it would be, I would make me miserable, it would make people around me miserable.
Yeah, you spread the pain around.
It
spread
the pain around, you know. And it's no good fruit come out of it.
Yeah.
But if we use it as our line to pray, and the more pain it is, it doesn't matter what it is, physical, spiritual, or heartache, to drive us to God, then he runs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because he knows, right? When if the pain is caused, the pain can cause by a lot of pain.
Yeah.
It can cause by ourselves, by enemy, or by just physical. But if it comes from Satan, he knows.
Yeah.
When she gets pain, and she's going to start talking
that's
to God,
right.
I'm going to run. Teach me when pain comes, is to pray. Just pray like crazy woman.
That's great. Yes. I appreciate that. Well put. Very good.
Great. Going back to Peter's question.
Yes.
Could we say that pain can become a curse, but only when we allow it to stop us from embracing life? And, you know, like, if pain, if fear of pain cages us in, then that is a curse.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, pain is something we should not fly from. We shouldn't fear it. We fear God. We don't fear pain. We're going to have pain in this life. And if you try to suppress it or flee from it, you're just going to cause more pain to yourself and to others. Yeah. So remember this pain here. Who ordained the pain? God did. If it comes from him, then somehow it's good. It's still painful. But it somehow there has our good in mind for it. It really does. Our time is about gone, and you can continue to study this chapter. There's so much more here. But I want to point out one word, because you won't get this unless you get it in the Hebrew and do some research. And it is found... Oh, there's so many things I want to share. But, two things. Verse 20. This seems like the most odd verse, the odd place to put this verse. The woman called his wife's name Chava, or Eve, because she was the mother of all the living. You know, you think he'd call her something else because she's the source of all our problems. The rabbis say Adam knew that for God's presence to dwell with him, he had to be united with his wife. And so he named her something good. Even though she caused pain and she had caused the exile from the garden, he still called her name Chava, the mother of all living. She didn't have any children yet. But it's like, look to the future, Eve. You're still going to be the mother of all the human beings who come into this world. And he united with her. And I think, let me read one verse, and then Deborah, while we're getting a microphone to you. I think Peter is alluding to this principle in 1 Peter 3:7. Says, "You husbands, likewise, live with your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life." Why? So that your prayers may not be hindered. Men, don't say that God's hearing your prayers? Then honor your wives more. Love her more. Be more understanding. Because you see, God's going to treat you the way you treat your wife. And God's going to listen to you. I see you punching your husband back there. The way you listen to your wife. All right, if you respond to her requests and desires, I'll respond to yours, you see. And so, Deborah, please. Okay. She did know. Oh, yeah. Well, no, she didn't. I don't think she knew the consequences of what happened. Yeah, but she knew she wasn't supposed to eat of that. Yeah. Adam would have told her. Priscilla, quit asking so many hard questions, all right? Don't give her the microphone anymore, Bill. No, I assume that she and Adam having everything in common, he would have certainly shared with her, okay, see that tree? Don't eat from that tree. All right? Now, she got it from Adam, not directly from God. But she would have known, absolutely. Okay, our time's up. Let me go through this, and then if you all want to take some more time, we will. But I really want to share this next verse with you. Verse 21, "And Adonai God made for Adam and his wife garments of skin, and he clothed them." Okay, let me ask some questions. He made them garments of skin. Did an animal lose its life to make these garments? It's not a tough question. Yes. We see the first death in the Bible here. Who made the garments? God did. Who put them on Adam and Eve? God did. All right? Now that word in Hebrew for he clothed them is only one word. It's v'yal b'shem. There it is. That's a mouthful. And he clothed them. That is the word right there. All right? V'yal b'shem. That word is found only two times in the entire Bible. You want to know what the other one is? Yes, Grant. Tell us what the other one is. Leviticus 8:13. "Next Moses had Aaron's son come near v'yal b'shem, and he clothed them." Now, if you read the context of Leviticus, what did he clothe them in? White linen garments. Now, did any animals die for those garments to be made? No. Did God make the garments or did man make the garments? Man make the garments. Did God put the garments on these Aaron and his sons or did Moses? Moses did. So we have this one word found two times in the Bible dealing with two kinds of garments. One made by God, one made by man. One requiring a death, one not requiring a death. One is placed on you by God himself, the only he could make, he puts it on you. The other is made by men according to Moses' Torah. What is this a picture of? You see, there's a garment of righteousness that is ours through Messiah. Only God can make it. It required the death of his son. And God puts it on us. You see, there's another garment that we make. We make it according to the rules of Moses, according to the Torah. And we weave it and we must put it on. And Revelation speaks of this garment. In Revelation 19, 7 and 8, it's talking about the bride. The bride is coming. It says, "Let us rejoice and be glad and give the glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride made herself ready." Who made her ready? She made herself ready. God made the bride, but she made herself ready. It was given to her to clothe herself and fine linen, bright and clean. And what is this fine linen? The fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints, the holy ones, the called out ones, us. There's a garment only God can make and requires a death, and he puts on you. But there's another garment that we make according to the rules of Moses, the Torah of Moses, the word of God. And we put it on ourselves. It's our wedding garment. Remember the parable of Yeshua sending, or the master of the feast sending out the people to gather all the ones on the highways and byways that come into the wedding feast? I don't care whether they're good and bad, but they have to come in. But he found one there without a wedding garment. And he said, how'd you get in here without a wedding garment? Out he goes. I think this is the wedding garment. There's a righteousness of a Messiah that only he can provide us. But he expects us to begin to live righteously, to produce righteous acts, to obey his word, to start to conform our lives to the life of a Messiah. Otherwise, it's just cheap grace. Yeah, I'll take it for you. It's free. Don't expect anything back. Even that truth is buried here in this passage in Genesis 3. It's pretty incredible. So I'm going to finish there. I've gone 8 minutes after. And I have a feeling we should probably just close right here. Is that all right? I know, Adam, you had something. Is that okay? And we'll talk at Oneg. So we can just continue this down in the while we eat. So let's go ahead and close in prayer. Our Father and King, we thank you so much for the riches of your Torah. Lord, how amazing your word is. And David prayed, Lord, uncover my eyes that I may behold wonders from your Torah. And Father, I feel like this morning you've done just that for us. And Father, I pray that as we encounter pain, and we will encounter pain, we would do it with joy. And that we would rejoice in all things, because we know they come from your hand. And we know that all things work together for good for those who love you and are called according to your purpose. So, Lord, help us to rejoice in our sufferings, but at the same time to weep with those who do weep and to bear one another's burdens and sorrows. But help us to always remember and never forget that all pain is birth pain. There's something wonderful and good at the other end if we will simply go through it and bear up and be courageous and patient. And Father, we thank you for the garment that you've provided us through the death of our Messiah. This garment that cost us nothing but cost him everything. But Father, I pray we would not neglect weaving together those fine white linen garments, the garments of priesthood, the garments of holiness. And we would weave them together by obeying your word and living righteous lives. So that we appear before you, we'll appear properly dressed. So make us the people you want us to be, and help us to continue to look at your Torah and to ask questions and to dig, and to continue to find the wonderful things you have hidden there for us to find. And we'll give you the praise and glory for it. In Yeshua's name, amen.